So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Man fans. I'm Ollie Mann. This is The Modern Man, and here is what's coming up today.
The winds don't really matter while you're in the air because obviously you don't feel them particularly. It's incredibly quiet and still, even if you're travelling at 40 miles an hour. But they matter quite a lot when you come in to land.
Is travelling across a desert, dangling from multiple helium balloons like in the Pixar movie Up, the future of the package holiday? Probably not. But if it is, I meet the man who can make that happen. Plus,
the orgasm is going to happen in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Alex Fox counts down to an exciting climax, and Ollie Peart pimps his ride. It's all to come on this edition of The Modern Man. But first, as in any good magazine, your letters. Hello to Tamsin, now in Italy, but last week in Ireland, from where she tweeted us to say, no matter how much you pack and prepare in advance, moving country always results in last-minute chaos. However, listening to The Modern Man has been the best company throughout my packing madness. Yes, Tamsin, I do love to binge on a back catalogue whilst completing a mundane task. I just hope you didn't get as far back as our episode, The Declutterer, because that may have caused some extra anxiety for you. Hello as well to Dan in Scotland, who got in touch after last week's Zeitgeist challenge, to say, if you want to make kefir taste better, just add a dash of concentrated squash from one of those pocket-sized bottles, such as Robinson's Squashed. That's SQUASH'D, apparently. Then the taste changes from a sour-tasting yoghurt to a lovely fruity drink, similar to Yop. Thank you, Dan. And by the way, how delightful that Yop still exists in our cynical world. I'd have assumed it had gone the way of Chambourcy Hippopotamus, but apparently not. If you want to get in touch, then reach out via the feedback form on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, or we are on Twitter at The Modern Man. Before we get going, though, big thanks to our sponsors for this episode, Beer52.com. They are deservedly the UK's number one beer club. I've got a little cupboard above my fridge where I keep my Beer 52 stash. That's partly so that guests can't see it because I don't want them drinking the good stuff. It's also partly because my wife can't monitor how much I'm drinking. I tend to secretly go for one whilst I'm cooking her dinner, and that brings me great pleasure. But there's no reason for you to have a special secret beer closet. You will want to be celebrating their world-class monthly selection of craft beer delivered to your door. They send you great stuff from California, from Norway, local beers too. It's all well worth a £24 a month subscription, but they have a special deal for you, Man fans. A free case of beer. This is not a drill. It really is free. 8 beers, a snack and a magazine, worth £24, free to you if you pay the £2.95 postage and packing. Now, it is a trial case, so if you don't want the monthly membership afterwards, you have to cancel, but it's genuinely 8 beers for free. Get your free case now at beer52.com/man. That's beer, the number 5, the number 2.com/MANN. And thanks again to them. Right, in this episode, you will learn what free writing for a hook line means, you'll discover a novel use for a £15 foldable camping chair, and you'll learn what has rendered Alex Fox speechless. I know, I didn't think that was possible. Let's go. Let's test out your listener-submitted trends with the man that the government calls Ollie Peart. Actually, they probably call you Oliver Peart, don't they?
Well, if someone calls you Oliver, you feel
You're talking specifically just about my mother and grandmother, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. You feel like you've done something wrong. So whenever the government write me a letter, I just assume it's a parking ticket.
Well, you've given me a key to your psyche now. So any time that a task goes badly, I'm going to call you Oliver.
Thanks.
So, Oliver, on last week's show, Manfan Deck tasked you with the challenge of getting your car wrapped.
He did.
How's that been going?
So I did a little Google, and one of the first things that popped up is a YouTube channel called Yanimize. And Yanomize is actually a bloke who owns a car wrapping place in Enfield. And he's made a career out of creating these YouTube videos where he wraps supercars, essentially. So Lamborghinis, Ferraris, Porsches.
Remind us of your brand of vehicle again.
Peugeot 206. So I had to find a car wrapping place nearer to me, and it just so happened there was one round the corner in Poole called Wraptastic. Yes. Because what they have to do, they have to see the car. And they have to see the car because they need to see whether or not there's any bumps or scrapes or dents in it. Because if there is, they can't do a proper wrap job on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Rust is the number one thing. It won't stick to it properly. And with the bumps, because you'll have like a little air bubble underneath the thing and it won't sit very well. So they had to inspect the car. That was like step one. So I got in the car to go and meet them, put the key in. Dead. Nothing at all. So I actually went in a different car and just showed them a photo. And they were like, well, this isn't good enough. So, chap there.
You wouldn't do that for an online date, would you? No. Turn up and say, sorry, I'm not the bloke that you're expecting, but here's a picture of my friend.
So I took them the picture and they were like, well, we need to see the car. And then I had to get the AA out. I had to get a brand new battery. I'm doing this for the podcast, by the way. And I took it there and they inspected the car. And then I found out how much it cost to get a car wrapped. So getting a car wrapped starts at about 900 quid. It's really expensive.
Jesus Christ. £900?
£900, yeah. It's a lot.
You haven't billed that to the podcast, have you? By which I mean my personal bank account.
Well, I was this close to doing so without your permission, but I thought better of it. So instead, we came up with an idea. So I'm selling my car anyway. I thought, well, the whole point of the wrapping thing is to make your car look awesome and great, and you could potentially add a decent chunk of value to it. So I said, look, if you wrap it for free, right, I want 500 quid for my car. And then whatever we make on top of the 500 quid, we'll give to charity.
I don't understand the deal that you've done. The car's worth £500.
Yeah.
We'll talk about you on the podcast.
Yeah.
So you'll wrap the car for free.
Yep.
And then if you sell the car for £600, mm-hmm. we'll give £100 to charity.
Yes.
Right, but they're still wrapping the car for free. You're trying to negotiate them down from £900 to nothing. Plus the general feel-good factor of having given £100 to charity.
Listen, they just want to get out to the wider world how amazing car wrapping is.
It's not a meet in the middle, is it? £900, I'll tell you what, how about nothing?
They went for it.
Did they? Wow.
But the reason they went for it is because they were like, we really want people to see that car wrapping is the way to go instead of having your car painted. And I'm not going to lie, I was a bit sceptical. If you're going to wrap a car, I could just imagine it scratching and ripping and coming off in like a few years' time. So they were very keen to show me that that wasn't the case. And they showed me all these different materials that you can have, and they sort of demonstrated them on how durable they are. And Rokas, who's the guy that does all the cars, he does all the wrapping, he is entering himself in the World Wrap Masters, basically the World Championships for car wrapping. And last year, right, so they don't wrap cars to demonstrate their skill, because that's just too easy. Last year, they wrapped a woman mannequin. And so showed me his car. So he's got a Vauxhall Astra. And on the roof of his car, it's a high-resolution image of the Vatican ceiling. And you look at it, and it's amazing. And he's very keen to like get his car key out and just scratch the top and say, look, it doesn't scratch.
Wow.
And it doesn't.
What happened? Have you wrapped your Peugeot 206?
Partially. We've done the roof. So this is what it looked like before.
That looks like a very boring Peugeot 206.
And this is what it looked like after.
Wow.
What do you think?
What is that? I think I'm at the London Planetarium in 1985.
Good.
And I'm on LSD.
It's kind of like an 80s sort of weird geometric-y type computer pattern. Reminds me of CGA graphics kind of thing.
If Patrick Moore ever presented an edition of Top of the Pops, that would be the title sequence.
Yeah, they just wanted a high-resolution image, and I wanted to do something that was linked to audio in some way. So it's like a waveform, but in 3D. That's what it is.
Oh, okay.
So there is a sort of a tenuous link. But I didn't want it to be too closely related, because otherwise we won't sell it and we're trying to make money for charity.
Well, Ollie, for entertainment value alone, this has been worth it. I hope it improves the value of your car. And thank you to Wraptastic for at least doing the roof.
Well, and they will do the rest. And we'll make money for
charity. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I'm looking forward to finding out. Right, time to check in with your other ongoing quest for the series, which is to write a Christmas song by the end of the series. Who have you been speaking to this week, Ollie?
I've spoken to Philip Mark Anquitil, and he is a music producer based out in Australia. And he's produced music for Little Mix, One Direction and Cher.
Bloody hell, why did he take your call?
He wants to help. He's really interested in producing.
Are you actually saying you've recruited a serious proper music producer to actually produce it?
This is the conversation that I have had with Philip. I said, I'm here because I want to make, and I've been challenged to create a Christmas number one. And he was like, that's
you haven't. You've taken this and run with it. Yeah. You were challenged simply to write a Christmas song.
When
this
have I ever done things by halves? When have I ever done things by halves? Never. Apart from maybe the car earlier.
I don't know when
I've
this became
by halves.
Write and sing and produce a Christmas number one by people who have worked with One Direction. That's like, you take it too far. You're flying too close to the sun.
I told him about some of the science stuff that I'd already been told last week about, you know, elements of the song and stuff. And said, can we put that into a song? And he said, well, listen, yes, we can. But you need to do one thing before you do anything else.
Overhaul your image completely and get it sung by someone else?
When I'm Christmas number one, I ain't going to look down at you from such a height. Anyway, he was like, you need to get yourself a hook line. And the only way you can get yourself a hook line is by free writing. And free writing is where you time yourself for like 10 minutes and you just write. So you know you're writing for a Christmas song and you're not allowed to be disturbed. You can't stop. You just got to go. So that's what I did. Here's a bit from like a couple of lines in. Christmas is a time to be with people, to listen to people, to hear people. That's a question for some reason. Christmas is about communicating. No, it isn't. What a load of shit. Okay, so snow, animals like deer or whatever. Sounds like Christmas. It sounds like Christmas time. Yes, right. Christmas is a time full of shit and bollocks. Stuff that doesn't really matter. What we need is to listen carefully to the sound of Christmas time. This is the time to listen to Christmas. Put on your headphones and listen to Christmas.
I quite like that. I quite like that. This is the time to listen to Christmas. Put on your headphones and listen to Christmas. That's quite fun for a chorus. The rest of it I'm not convinced about, I'll be honest.
So I've sent all of that to Phil, and hopefully he won't run away. And the idea is that he'll look at it and he'll make a song from it.
Whoa, hold on a minute.
What?
That's not you writing a Christmas song, is it?
Well,
that's
I'll help him tweak
it. You're putting 10 minutes work in and then a professional producer is going to choose the best bits and turn it into a song for you.
Whoa. Ollie, it's not 10 minutes. Okay, that is 32 years worth of Christmas experiences combined into a mental spew that he is going to work into something magical. It is a writing credit, and that is the point. I will have a writing credit on a Christmas number one.
As ever, I disapprove of the method. I admire the ambition. Time for next week's challenge. It comes from Hannah in Tunbridge Wells, who says, I travel a lot for work, and this week heard about Premier Inn's new pod hotels. Can Ollie stay in one and tell us about them?
She wants me to stay in a hotel.
Well, what she wants is you to be her one-man trip advisor, basically. Premier Inn have decided to open a whole new chain of hotels where the rooms are half the size of a normal Premier Inn room, which in the first place is a budget hotel room. It's less than half the price, I think, to stay there, but you're staying in a tiny little space.
So she wants a small
person. So she wants to know whether that's worthwhile.
To stay in a small hotel.
Yeah, you could stay in a coffin and you'd like be like, oh, this is very roomy in here.
I mean, it's fine by me. Where are you sending me?
Well, that's up to you. You can take the brief and run with it, as you so often do. I mean, I know that the trend, it doesn't have to be Premier Inn. I mean, you can stay in any pod hotel, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Let us know why they're the next hot thing. And I imagine they are hot because most of them don't have windows. If you have a challenge for Mr. Pitt for next week's show, then head over to our website, monmanwith2ends.co.uk, and click feedback, and you can suggest it there. Coming up next, you will meet the man who flew over Botswana with some party balloons. But first, it's time for our record of the week. It's by East London quartet Free Money. It's their new track, You Got Me, and it's out now on Communion Records.
Well, I'd hide my feelings from you, feelings for too confused about it, or maybe just too shy. I didn't notice it at the time. You were right in front of my eyes. Remember back in June that night when you were drunk and so was I. All the trains had stopped, you said you had to stay, we shared a bed.
Now, when I heard that one man had flown over South Africa attached to some helium balloons,
I was intrigued. And when I found out that he wanted to market this to the general public as a race you could enter, I wanted to meet him. His name is Tom Morgan, and he runs a travel company out of Bristol called The Adventurists. They now run 27 events annually in 11 countries, including the Rickshaw Run, a two-week journey with no set route spanning the length of India, but you must be driving a clapped-out rickshaw, and the Mongol Rally, which involves crap cars and a journey to Mongolia. You'll hear about that in a sec. I started by asking Tom what the first trip was that he organised.
The first one I think I organised for myself and my friends was going to the West Bank and Egypt, I think.
Wow. Okay, that's not Magaluf.
People chasing us out of their streets with stones, having no plan. When travelling around Africa a year later, completely ran out of money the days before mobile phones, and then having no money for food or lodging.
But that's what you liked.
Well, I liked the feeling of being in a situation where you're required to make decisions that actually have an impact on what's going to happen in the next day, next 10 minutes, rather than in our modern world where you can make as many decisions as you like and, you know, you can undo them with your mobile phone the next second. You're never lost. You're never stuck anywhere, really. And then the other thing, myself and a friend, Jules, had bought a really shit Fiat 126 when we were on the exchange in Prague. And then just randomly picked a place on the map and tried to get there. And
what was that place?
The place was Mongolia. So we had a shit little car.
Went from the Czech Republic to Mongolia?
Yeah.
Where does that... I'm just scanning the world in my head. Where does that take you through?
So we had planned to go through Southern Europe and then Greece, then Turkey, then Iran, then Afghanistan, then Tajikistan, I think, from there, and then up through Kazakhstan into Russia.
Okay, that's quite a place to pick on the map.
We looked for the most ridiculous place we could find. So we had this crap little car, which turned out to be two cars badly welded together, we discovered later on. Mm-hmm. We got completely done. And then we set off and we made sure we checked each other's luggage to make sure we had none. So I think we had one pair of pants was our allowance for luggage, spare pants. And then we had
Why?
We were just trying to make life difficult.
But why? That's personal hygiene. That's not... Yeah. That's one thing, not having a map.
Yeah, I don't know.
Another thing, just having sweaty balls for 3 weeks.
Yeah, it wasn't very well thought through, like all these things.
Was the idea that you'd buy underwear en route?
Not particularly. We were just wanted to get out and find out what happened. It didn't work. It was a total shit show.
What did happen?
We got to the border with Iran in... Eastern Turkey, and they just refused to let us in.
Right.
Probably because it was so smelly. I don't know. It was still incredible fun, even though we totally failed to do what we intended to do. And I think that's the difference. Like, if you go on holiday to India and you want to see the Taj Mahal and you don't see the Taj Mahal, it's a disaster. If you have no particular plan, it's going to be interesting whatever happens. And I think actually I get a lot more enjoyment, probably the enjoyment people would expect to get from discovering the Taj Mahal by strolling across a kind of, the world's a kind of really shit pub, but you meet someone really interesting and, and that kind of serendipity of travel that is quite a rewarding experience, and you get to meet people around the world and that you would not normally meet. And I think that's far more interesting and engaging.
Did you break down in the Fiat?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, it was an absolute piece of shit.
So what happened when you broke down and you were in Greece and you didn't speak Greek and you weren't in a tourist area?
I tried to just fiddle with the engine until it worked again. And gradually I learned mechanics quite over the course of having a lot of crap cars. Or you just stop and ask people.
So tell me how that then spawned the idea of the Mongol Rally.
So I invited people. I created a website, used the Royal We quite a lot and lied about being organised. And then invited people to come along. And I, for some reason, thought there would be thousands of people turning up. But there weren't. There were only like six cars.
And the idea was what?
To drive to Mongolia in a shit car. So
from
London this time. So okay, we're going to go London to Mongolia in a car under a litre.
And when you say you set up a website, were people giving you money for this? Or it was just turn up at this place, we'll all go together?
It was free, yeah. I did it for fun. So it was me again. A guy in a Robin Reliant. A couple of friends in a Nissan Micra. That's Peugeot 205.
Okay, so what is the ultimate shit car then?
In my mind, it's a Fiat 126.
Yeah. Well, is that, that's not what you had this time as well, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
was
it? I've had five of them in my time.
Did you go and get another one? What year was it from?
80, there must have been 80-something.
Right.
It's rubbish. It's got a radiator at the back. It overheats. But yeah, they're great. The rubbishness of the car is important because that forces you to break down and it adds another element of unknown. That's why we say crap car, because then you don't know if you're going to make it.
So this time you knew you were going to Mongolia and presumably you planned what would happen when you got to the border in Iran.
Yes, yeah. We actually went a different route. Russia, Kazakhstan, Russia again, Mongolia. The worst roads were definitely Kazakhstan. There's a huge stretch, which is now good roads, which was basically just mud. And I'd never seen potholes that you could put your entire car in and hide it. There was one point where the front, it has a leaf suspension at the front and it snapped and both wheels went kind of sideways and splayed out and sat on the ground. And then we got some guys for about £3 to weld the back suspension of a Russian car so that we were driving with the kind of front wheels high up in the air.
So these people that had come along on this first Mongol rally then, that you didn't know, where had they discovered it from?
A friend of mine had a like phones for you equivalent company.
Uh-huh.
And he agreed to mail out to his customers.
Wow.
So he didn't have, like, it wasn't like phones for you
data
sales.
Regulations.
Yeah.
Just to email all my customers something completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And it was one of those guys came and just turned up in a car.
Yeah.
Okay, so the third time that you organised it,
yeah.
How many people showed up then?
40-something cars, 42 cars.
At that point, did you think this could be my job?
No,
did that come later?
At that point, I was still, this is...
thinking about...
Yeah, we charged £50, I think, then.
Uh-huh.
So that just covered the cost of hiring Hyde Park before they decided that they hated us.
Now, how many cars enter the Mongol Rally?
About 400.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Every year?
Yeah.
How did you go from all of that to strapping a load of helium balloons to yourself and flying over South Africa?
Well, that, I think, is going to be a new race that the world is going to queue up to take part in.
Are you being serious, though?
Yeah.
Okay, so talk me through what happened.
As I get more competent at things like fixing cars, it becomes less exciting. So at night now, I'm quite good at fixing cars because I've had so many shit ones. The Mongol Rally is probably... becomes less exciting because I'm more competent at that scenario. So then we try and push to do more and more stupid, different things, so just keep finding something interesting. And that led to party balloons.
What balloons?
Party balloons.
Are they actually literally party balloons that you use?
They were a bit bigger, but they are from a party shop. Yeah.
Okay, so explain the idea.
Everyone has obviously held helium balloons and wondered, you know, how many more do you need to take off? Fairly standard childhood dream. And then I found an old article from a Popular Mechanics, 1905, something like that. No, 1920, but it talked about a 1905 race by Gordon Bennett called the Gordon Bennett Cup, which was this gas balloon race where they started... in one location with one fill of gas with what's now called a Gordon Bennett envelope, which is 1,000 cubic meters. So you had a standard amount of gas and then you took off and then you had to get as far as you could in any possible direction. And it was total disaster.
Took off in what?
In a balloon, like a basket.
Air balloon, but with helium balloons.
Hydrogen, I think, in those days.
Okay.
Yeah, extra unwise.
Uh-huh.
So they had 1,000 cubic meters, which is a big balloon. So they had teams of two or three people wafting about Europe. And it was a pretty much a massive disaster. I think they had like a few people died and got lost. And,
okay. and then, you rediscovering this in the 2000s, you thought this
sounds
great.
Yeah, well, it still runs. It's a lot more organized now.
Okay.
There is an annual Gordon Bennett Cup, but it's really expensive because obviously you need fancy balloons.
Yeah.
And it's not as much fun as party balloons or as cheap. So I thought, well, we can combine the two, go cheap and accessible and funnier.
So what were your initial experimentations? I mean, did you literally go to the party shop, get 50 balloons and see whether it would lift you off the ground?
Yeah. There's a gas shop just around the corner from here in the office and bought more helium than there were. Lots of questions, which I avoided. And then tied them to an office chair in Dorset. We remained tied to the ground because I was pretty sure it was highly illegal.
Yeah. I was going to say also, like, I imagine the first time you do that... You are thinking, well, this might be funny, but this is exactly the kind of small scale way in which I could definitely die. Like, yeah. You know, falling 12 foot onto my pelvis or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a really unspectacular, stupid thing to do. Yeah. So, okay, yeah. So you were tethered to the ground.
Yeah.
And you did take off?
Yeah,
in an office chair.
Just.
You, yeah. Sitting in it.
Yeah, 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 just about.
Was it fun?
Yeah, it is. It's very strange, I think, because you're not used to things pulling you up quietly. Like, you know, aircrafts tend to be noisy or loud or, you know, or things pull down because of gravity. But this very strange, completely silent force lifting you up is quite amazing.
Because even, obviously, hot air balloons, you get this.
Quite noisy. Yeah, yeah, it's really loud. It feels very mechanical in a hot air balloon. If you stop doing anything, you come down. Whereas this, if you stop doing anything, you go up.
Okay, so then what was the idea about moving that into a maneuverable craft? Because, like you say, you just keep going up unless you find a way of steering it or bring yourself back down again.
Well, then wanted to try and make that into a long-distance race, like the Gordon Bennett Cup. So, actually, party balloons, I think, are probably a relatively safe way to fly because you have multiple points of failure. So like a big hot air balloon, you can set it on fire and fall screaming from the sky.
Yeah.
Whereas unless you hit a flock of really angry and determined birds, you're probably going to be all right.
Yeah, or at least you'll fall slowly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Just a few compound fractures rather than complete annihilation.
Okay, you're answering a different question. I said, how do you steer it? You're answering a question about how do you avoid death. Is it basically not steerable?
You can't, it's not steerable. Yeah, no, correct.
You just go straight up.
You can steer it in that if you have good weather information, like any hot air balloon, the winds are at different directions at different heights. So if you know the wind really well, you're planning, say, to fly from A to B, you can go to B based on where you think A, you know, where you'll end up, roughly where A is. But on this one, you don't have a clue where you're going to go, I think, because it's over a longer period of time. I don't think it matters. So we're going to start somewhere in the middle of a continent where there's a lot of land to crash into and where we're allowed to do it. And then go in any direction. I don't think it matters.
So you personally did the first version of this trip that you're trying to establish.
Yes, yeah.
What did you do?
Well, we went to Botswana and got it hideously wrong. I went with a friend, Buddy, and we were supposed to be actually having a little mini race to try it out. And we were in the middle. We went to the Makadi salt pans in Botswana, which is a big open area, and just started filling balloons up. And then it was very windy. They kept being destroyed. So we built an entire cluster of balloons, and then you got a gust of wind, and it just smashed them into the ground and burst half of them. And then,
did you think at that point, this is a bad idea, we should stop? I mean, if you've just seen 25 balloons combust in front of you.
Yeah, I did think this is a bad idea, but I just spent a huge amount of money trying to get us into the desert, so I felt like a massive dick if I stopped. So we kept trying.
What was the desert, the legality thing? Was that because you can't fly in the middle of a city?
Yeah, space and set. And, you know, if you're going to try this out, you want a big open area where you've got a few more choices. And also to make it more interesting as well. You know, if we can drift around in Africa, it's going to be more fun than Scotland.
But also you're going to presumably, I mean, I'm sure you thought about this, but find yourself dropped in potentially the middle of a lion's den. And you haven't got any support there, have you? Or
no,
did you have a team following you or what?
We had people on the ground, but there's no way they're unlikely to be able to get to you quickly. We did think about that, but I assume they're going to run away from
hundreds of helium balloons.
Yeah, a brightly coloured object floating down from the sky.
Okay, so a lot of assumptions at play. And presumably it wasn't an office chair by this point.
No, it wasn't. It was, I didn't want to pay extra on the baggage. So we bought a camping chair out there. It's in the warehouse, I can show you. So cheap, it was like 15 quid.
Like a foldable camping chair?
Yeah.
So it's a foldable camping chair that costs 15 quid. Did you trust, I mean, seriously, did you think, is that going to support your weight at height? I mean, you couldn't test it, could you, till you did it?
Well, I put a rope through the chair, so I knew that if the chair collapsed, I'd be sitting on the rope.
Right, okay.
So I wasn't too worried about the chair. It was more about comfort.
So you blow up loads of balloons, half of them smash.
Yeah.
When you get to the stage where the thing is beginning to rise and it's tethered.
Yes.
Do you what, then you then sit in it and say, right, let's keep going until I start lifting, or what?
Yeah, well, we tried for like 2 weeks. We ran out of water and food.
2 weeks?
Yeah. No, sorry. It was a 2-week trip. So we were there in the desert, like a long, long drive away from any supplies. We had no food or water left. It kept going wrong because we were trying to fight these weather windows to try and get it up and inflate it before the wind had turned and we could get into the air. We totally got it wrong. We destroyed all but enough balloons to just about get one person off the ground. And then we'd run out of water. So literally the only, it sounds like an excuse, but the only liquid we could buy was beer from quite a long way away. So we just kind of had to give up on that location. And we had just enough balloons to try again. And one of our vets on the Mongol, we phoned one of the guys who was out there helping, is a South African guy who was a great guy called Charles.
Veterinarian.
Veterinarian, yeah. So
not a, right.
Not as in
all. Not a veteran.
No. He knew one of the vets in South Africa who had a friend who had this absolutely enormous horse stadium, which was indoors. So we thought, okay, right, fuck this desert. It's not going to work. And we've only got one attempt left. So we had like a 4-hour weather window in South Africa where we thought we could try it. Because by this point, I was getting a bit desperate that we'd spent all this money and got all these people out here to do absolutely nothing. So we legged it down, filled it up inside the warehouse. It was obviously the thing we should have done to start with because it worked really well.
We're doing it inside?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then took all the balloons out one by one and tied them into the chair at four in the morning. And then it was tied to the ground. Then, yeah, you sit in it. And you, I had jerry cans filled with water with a little tap on.
Yeah.
So that had ballast, which means that then if you want to go up, you can release water. And if you want to come down, you can get rid of a balloon. So I sat in it with too much water and then released the water until I was buoyant. And that way you don't get it massively wrong and you go flying up it.
And what stops the chair from angling downwards and you tumbling out?
Tying it on really well to the string. So we had a bit of climbing harness above. It was a kind of a hoop that goes through the chair. And then above that were clips to attach the balloons onto. So I could see, I wanted to be able to isolate individual balloons. Because if you cut off like 6 balloons, you're going to fall really fast towards the ground, which I didn't particularly want to do.
And when you say cut off, did you have literally a pair of scissors with you?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's cartoonish, isn't it? That's why it's funny. The whole idea is very Roadrunner.
And it's colourful as well, which is nice.
It's petrifying.
Yes, it is.
I can imagine it being beautiful when you're up there.
Yeah.
And I can imagine the visual impact of it, like I say, being amusing.
Yeah.
But... you're married, aren't you? You've got two kids.
Yeah, I'm married and 2 kids. Yeah.
So how did you... I mean, there must have been a part of you that thought, if this kills me, I'm a fucking idiot.
Yeah, a lot of me was thinking that. And I was terrified. And I think, actually, it going so wrong to begin with meant that it was so busy in the lead up to it. Because we travelled through the day, worked all through the night. So we hadn't slept for a long time, maybe 3 days, 4 days, that I didn't have time to think about it. So it was just in it going, oh, fuck. And then by that point, you're quite committed. But I was also, I think, through watching it go wrong, we gradually refined the process so that I was more confident of the engineering, in inverted commas, that we had employed.
So is your vision for this, because you talked about this becoming a sort of more mainstream product that you can offer through your company, but is your vision through this that you supply all the technology? Because the whole point of the Mongol Rally is people find their own crap car.
No.
Or is it that people get their own helium balloons?
Yes, it's the latter, that they'll get their own, partly because I don't want to be responsible for their shit decisions.
Yeah. I mean, that could lead to people dying.
Yeah. I don't think it will. I think it's
But it could. I mean, it's a strong possibility, isn't it?
I'm not sure it's a strong possibility. I think it's, as I said, it's got multiple points of failure. I think probably less so than something like the rickshaw run where you're dodging Indian traffic. I suppose then there's the exposure and the lions and the... Yeah, it's pretty stupid.
Have you got other people, you know, queuing up to join you on this one?
I haven't asked yet, but I'm pretty sure there will.
You think?
Yeah. It's not going to be big because it's going to be quite difficult to organise. So, and it's going to be relatively expensive just because helium's expensive.
Yeah, well, on that as well, I mean, if this becomes a mass thing, people will say, well, you're abusing a precious resource.
Because
it's used by the medical industry, isn't it?
It is, but they're getting more, that's slightly overhyped. There's more of it than people think. And we can always use hydrogen.
How long were you in the air?
Only an hour and a half in the end, 2 hours, because of that weather window. So the winds don't really matter while you're in the air, because obviously you don't feel them particularly. It's incredibly quiet and still up there, even if you're traveling at 40 miles an hour. but they matter quite a lot when you come into land. And the wind was gusting 40 or 50 knots at the end of the weather wind. That was the forecast. So we wanted to get on the ground before that happened. And I got down, I was going to swap with Buddy. And actually the winds came early and they started doing the same thing where they were ripping the balloons off the strings. That's not so ideal. Because again, in the sky, that's not too bad. But when you come to land and you're traveling at whatever 40 knots is in real money, and you're being dragged along the ground, that's going to suck.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a calculation as well, based on not having the experience, just instinct, isn't it?
Yeah.
You didn't know you weren't going to get dragged across the ground when you landed. How did you land?
It was amazingly straightforward, actually. The actual landing when I landed was quite almost like I knew what I was doing. It was fairly soft, but just by chance. I think I came in to land a couple of times and undercooked it. So I was really worried about smashing into the ground and like compressing my spine and crying in pain for a long time. So I was like coming in really gently, and I just kept bouncing off some kind of thermals on the ground or something. And then I went, okay, if I'm going to come in and land, I need to. And yeah, I realized I had to be quite decisive, or you just like waft about into telegraph poles and things.
And now you're working on a flat pack printed biplane.
Yeah.
You're going to have to unpack for me what that means. I mean, a biplane, that's like a World War I aircraft, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So flat pack?
Laser cut out of plywood. My goal is to make something that's really cheap. I originally thought under £1,000, which I maybe can't reach once you've got an engine and things. It needs to be super lightweight, so under 70 kilograms, because that changes the regulation.
What regulation?
The one where you need a pilot's license.
Okay. So this is another adventure holiday, really. I know you don't like calling it that, but it is, where someone would get a pack with a plane in it.
Yes, they'd build it themselves. My goal would be that the final design will take only a kind of a day to build the rough structure, and then obviously you've got to fanny about with it. But I want it to be quick to build.
And building the plane sounds awesome. Getting in it... It's not for
less
me.
So, yeah, fair enough.
I mean, who's it for? Like, who?
I don't know.
That's again, it's a risk, isn't it? It's a huge. Would you get in a plane you built yourself? Want to know what you're doing. Yeah.
Not straight away. I think that my other theory is that because it will be cheap to make, I can like fly them destructively for quite a long time, and just make sure that it works by remote control, and then before I get in it.
Where could you go in something of that weight?
Where would we do it?
Yeah, what kind of distance could you travel?
I don't know. My goal, and this is probably through gigantic ignorance, is to go from Hawaii to Micronesia across the Pacific.
Okay.
That's what I think we're doing. But
how far have you got with the development of that then?
Not very far yet. I've made lots of designs. I'm getting the first bits laser cut out soon, and then we're going to start destroying it. And the reason a biplane is because... to keep it cheap, I want to use kind of plywood, which is not a highly structural material. And a biplane is kind of inherently structurally sound because you've got a kind of box shape around the wings.
What's driving you to create these experiences for people?
I want to do them myself, I think. I've always wanted a plane. But I tried to build a biplane when I was about 5 in the shed out of plywood. And I'm telling myself it's not related, but it was a complete bag of shit. Obviously, I was 5. Just had loads of bits of plywood badly screwed together. I always dreamed about flying a homemade aircraft over a jungle to an island. Yeah, that's all right. Maybe that is too much of a coincidence. That probably is like some deep-seated islandy childhood obsession.
What's your message to people that are listening to this who are seeing all the ads on the telly to book their summer holidays for this year and... you know, the stuff that's being pushed at people is, you know, book yourself a cruise, go to Sandals.
Yeah. I would say go for it if you're sure that's what you want, but consider there are more interesting things out there that will be far less relaxing, and you probably will need a holiday afterwards, but that will be ultimately more interesting.
Where do you go with your kids?
Oh, like Sardinia. Somewhere where there's like a sea and... it's really easy to manage them. So, I do like holidays. I'm not anti-holidays.
So
I like sitting around drinking wine and...
yeah.
I hate beaches, but I do generally like holidays.
So when you're in Sardinia and you're drinking wine, do you take time out to free dive off a cliff, or do you just manage to keep all that in a box?
Yeah, that's in a box, yeah. I think that I see them as completely distinct things. I don't think what we do is a version of a holiday or travel. I think it's a totally different thing.
It's like a life experience, isn't it?
Yeah, like a hobby of some kind, yeah.
It's actually introducing an element of spontaneity and danger into people's lives where that isn't part of their life.
Yeah, and I think increasingly that is hard to find. People's lives get busier and then people invent gadgets to make that more convenient, and it becomes increasingly impossible to find a way to not know what's going on. And that's fine, that's convenient, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think humans were born in an age where we had to run away from tigers. There is a need for people to rely on your kind of instinct. I think people feel better for it.
Tom Morgan of The Adventurists, and some of the extraordinary pictures from Tom's flight in South Africa are on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. Alex Fox is up next after this.
Now time for sex tips from a woman whose sexual pleasures are always sky high. It's Alex Fox with The Foxhole. How are you, Alex?
I have seen a spectacular play by a young female playwright called Isley Lynn, which is called Skin a Cat, that deals with the subject of vaginismus, which I believe we've mentioned on the show before.
Yes. Vaginas that sort of lock, if that's not too crude a way to describe it.
Lockable foofs. Yeah, it's a condition where the muscles of the vagina spasm and clamp up involuntarily to the point where penetrating with a finger or a tampon or a penis becomes painful to the point of impossibility.
Yes.
There are lots of things that the play brings up which I found particularly interesting. For a start, it busts a heck of a lot of myths. It takes away the prevalent idea that people with vaginismus must be asexual or not desiring to have sex in any way. The protagonist really, really wants to consummate her relationship. She really wants to have penetrative sex, but it's just not happening for her. Another interesting approach that it takes is to consider vaginismus perhaps not a problem that needs to be solved, but something that you can work with. And for me, that's quite revolutionary.
Okay, time for our sex question of the week. It comes from Jen, who says, as a woman, I seem to struggle with the opposite issue to most when it comes to having an orgasm. For me, they happen easily and through penetrative sex. I'm sure plenty of people would now like to get in touch with Jen, but she isn't single, I'm afraid. Although at first glance, this doesn't seem like a problem. It's gotten to the point, after I've come for the fifth or sixth time in 15 or 20 minutes, my body is exhausted. So, Alex, do you have any tips to keep my orgasms at bay so that I can keep pace with my potential new partner? He said he thinks it's great, but I do get embarrassed by it.
Now, as she says, at first listen, a lot of people would go, oh, what's the problem here? But actually, this is something that I can kind of relate to. In my recent times, I have been becoming intimate with a gentleman. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it's the chemistry between us, his particular techniques. I don't know. Everything seems to be, all the pieces, all the magical Tetris pieces seem to be slotting together in such a way that I find myself in almost a perpetual rolling state of orgasm when we're together.
And this quickly. So what would normally be an oven bake has become a microwave.
It renders me speechless, which I know is a very hard concept for anybody who knows me to even imagine. I can barely get a sentence out when we are playing together, which he finds highly amusing. But I do have some guilt because I turn into this gelatinous, jellified, just a mess, just an absolute melted mess so quickly when I'm with him that I feel that I can't actually pay attention to returning the favour or doing my, you know, doing my part in making sure that the pleasure is reciprocal.
You've lost some of your game.
I'm game over before I've even started. Just seem to have, I've lost all of my potency, if you will.
See, now what's very interesting about what you're saying is that you have a wide variety of sexual experiences as detailed previously on the show, and yet this seems to be being caused by this new partner of yours. Now what Jen is saying is that actually her sexual history is she always comes very quickly. So it sounds in her case, maybe it's more physical, less emotional.
Well, this is an important point, really, because it suggests that for some people, this is a permanent condition and it might be to do with the way that they're physically wired. Mm. Whereas for other people like me, it may well be psychological. It might be to do with how relaxed I feel in this particular scenario or the intensity of atmosphere and mood created. It might be a lot to do with the partner. Now, often when we talk about orgasms happening too soon or sex feeling too overwhelming for a person, more frequently than not, we are discussing men.
Yes.
It's really important that we also acknowledge that this can happen to women too. In fact, in its most extreme form, it's called persistent genital arousal disorder, which is a situation where women, or men in fact, it can happen to men too, but it's been documented in quite a few women, experience spontaneous, persistent, unwanted and uncontrollable genital arousal. And that can even happen completely in the absence of sexual stimulation. Long story short, there are women out there who are coming all the time, even though they don't want to. Going back to Jen's particular situation here, there will certainly be people out there who say, well, what's the problem? Because women don't have the same refractory period as men, meaning that they can
keep going.
Essentially, yeah, recover from an orgasm quickly and have another one.
Well, I must be honest, when I was reading Jen's email, that is kind of what I was thinking until I got to the bit where she said, after I've come five or six times in 15 or 20 minutes. Because I think if it was, you know, two or three times, then you, I mean, as a man, I think that'd be great if I could do that. Like, if that would, it would curb any problem of thinking, am I going to come too soon? Because then you have to wait for possibly indefinitely if you've killed the mood completely, but certainly at least 5 or 10 minutes. Whereas in her case as a woman, if it is possible to keep going and it's just as pleasurable the second and third time, what's the problem? But then you get to six times and you're thinking, you know, Christ, you're going to be exhausted.
Well, much like Jen's highly sensitive vulva, the problem here is multifold. The problems can be psychological and physical. So physically, she's likely to feel absolutely knackered.
Yeah.
Orgasms, depending on the type that you have and the way you personally experience it within your body, can be, you know, a very physical, clenchy experience. Lots of people naturally feel really tired afterwards and even achy in some cases. You can also feel very sore or just highly sensitive afterwards. Jen may actually find that being touched after she's come, especially several times, might almost feel painful or at least overwhelming. Lots of men say that immediately after they've reached climax that they don't want their penis to be touched because it's just too much. So physically she might be experiencing that, those kind of issues. Psychologically, lots of women who come really easily and quickly say they feel like they're being selfish because this situation renders it quite difficult for them to concentrate on their partner's pleasure or on creating a scene. Or sex isn't just about orgasm. And if you want it to be about creating a mood or escapism, then if you're coming that quickly and it's becoming painful to carry on within 5, 10, 15 minutes, then that might scupper the larger goal that you want to achieve with your intimate experience.
Okay, so let's offer her some tips then.
First up, sex is not just about the genitals.
Oh, you're not going to start saying we need to talk about things again.
Well, talking about it is always a good idea in sex. But Jen and her partner have whole bodies. They are holistic beings.
Oh, yes.
If stimulating the clitoris or if penetration are what is pushing Jen over the brink faster than she wants to be, then this is a great opportunity for them to explore sensory pleasures of the rest of the body. That might not even involve touching at all. It might involve reading each other erotic stories or speaking to each other in a sexy way. Or
that's really nice, but if it's building up to penetrative sex and she comes really quickly during penetrative sex, if she's been sort of put into gear, so to speak, by extensive foreplay, then that might exacerbate the problem, mightn't it? It might be over in seconds.
Well, in that case, perhaps the foreplay, although as we know, I don't really like that word, perhaps the play can focus more
sex,
on her partner for a while.
Yeah.
So she might want to pleasure him with oral sex or with giving him a hand job, or this might be a great opportunity to explore some toys that stimulate the penis or the prostate. So place the focus on pleasuring him for a while. Something that I have observed about myself and have been thinking a lot about lately is that if I add in certain extra sensations during an intimate experience, so if there's music playing, if there's someone speaking to me, if maybe my neck or my back or my scalp are being stimulated, all of those things for me help to prolong a pleasurable experience. But because they're kind of diluting and dissipating the sensory input that I've got, They almost act as a distraction for me. This may not play out the same way for Jen. Some people find that multi-sensory input brings them to orgasm faster, whereas other people like me find that it allows them to prolong an experience because their pleasure is not so genitally focused. Mm-hmm. So Jen might want to put that
put
one
a record
in the mix. Yeah, yeah. Her partner and her do need to have a conversation. I know that you'll probably roll your eyes there, Ollie.
God's sake.
One thing,
the perfect situation. He doesn't want to ruin this with a conversation, surely.
Well, I think it's important that he realises that bringing Jen to climax over and over again, although in mainstream society that might be seen as a real point of pride for him and a real positive thing, in this case, it may not be all the time. She needs to know that she's got permission to tap out and take a little bit of a break, or that she can feel confident in saying to him, I need a rest, without him feeling like he needs to plow on with the plowing. So if they could have that conversation, and maybe he's got some ideas of things that he would like to try that can, you know, that are more whole body focused, or things that she can do for him so she feels like she's a full part of that intimate experience, that aren't going to get in a way waylaid by her overwhelming orgasms. I also spoke to a woman called Nim, who has exactly the same problem as Jen. And she says, I've managed to stave off orgasms if I really concentrate. And one thing that's really helped her is exploring a dominant and submissive relationship where she gets her partner to give her permission to tell her when to come. And she said that setting up that power dynamic makes her feel more like her partner is directly involved in the orgasm happening, rather than it just being a thing that instantly happens without either of them really thinking about it. I think that could even be taken further by perhaps if they counted to five together, like the orgasm is going to happen in 5, 4, 3, 2. Counting that together has that power play dynamic, which a lot of people find very exciting and might bring a new dimension to Jen's sexual experiences, which previously have sounded a bit like a bit one track, if you will. It can help slow it down, but also just 5 seconds should hopefully be manageable. And they can even make this an exciting thing to work on themselves.
That's a good
together
idea.
You know, it can be a mutual challenge.
It's interesting as well, because a lot of the advice, again, thinking of this from a male point of view in terms of premature ejaculation, would be around, this is other men advising each other, by the way, I'm not talking about if you ask a sexual therapist, would be distract yourself, think about something else. That's the classic schoolboy way of dealing with it. Whereas actually what you're saying is something almost tantric, where you go deeper.
Yeah, we spoke about Tantra in the last season, and one idea that came up, which I thought was a really fascinating and compelling one, was that rather than trying to put your mind somewhere non-sexual if you're trying to avoid coming, that you can actually just move your focus and your thoughts to somewhere else on your body that's also pleasurable but at a lower level. So you might concentrate on how your feet feel, or the back of your knees, or the inside of your elbows, somewhere that's still sensual but is not genitally focused. That way you're not breaking that mood, you're not having to allow the hideousness of Margaret Thatcher or oatmeal or emptying the bins or whatever it is to stutter your experience and to halt that pleasure. You're just moving it elsewhere. And speaking of moving, Nim did give one final tip that I absolutely love. This is actually rather selfish and sneaky, but sometimes I do try and scoot onto my partner's side of the bed during foreplay, because lots of orgasms leads to lots of expulsions of fluid and I just want him to sleep in the wet patch. So which brings us to a nicely soggy conclusion.
If you have a question of sex for Alex to answer on next week's show, what do you have to do with it?
Roll out of your soggy sheets and use your fingers to navigate to our website, which is modernmanwith2ns.co.uk, and hit feedback.
And tweets from Alex Fox can never come too soon. Where can people follow you online?
At Alex Fox, that's A-L-I-X, one I in there. And then Fox, like the rusty-coloured animal that rifles through your garbage pails.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this week's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new manbassador. It's Nate in Montana, who posted us the following 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. He says, I started listening to this show after hearing about it on Answer Me This, and now look forward to every episode. It helps keep me entertained and awake on my many, many long drives, as I live in remote Montana, the nearest grocery store being a 4-hour drive away round trip. Nate, don't forget the milk, but I am pleased to appoint you Manbassador for Montana. If you'd like to post us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you found this show, please do. It really helps other people discover what we're up to. Until next time, our music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.